Right, so the next case on our docket is Rose LLC versus Treasure Island LLC, case number 71941. Make sure that all of the attorneys, please state your name for my court clerk and introduce any parties or any attorneys that may be with you. Also, I should ask when you address the court, let us know how much time you'll need in rebuttal argument as the appellant.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Abraham Smith and Dan Polsenberg for Rose LLC.
How much time would you like for rebuttal argument?
5 minutes, thank you.
5 minutes? All right, that'll be the order. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Judge Silver. Good morning, Your Honors. The issue in this case is actually very simple. To terminate a long-term tenancy and take that extraordinary remedy of forfeiting that real property interest. Does the landlord have to comply with the contractual preconditions taking that extraordinary remedy? And now, most of this is well briefed in the briefs, but I did want to call Your Honor to one point, which is the issue of forfeiture. We see sometimes in Treasure Island's brief, they reference that they're forfeiting their right to terminate and that should somehow be weighed against Rose LLC's forfeiture of its real property interest. So I think it's important to distinguish what really is a forfeiture. At the end of the novel Anna Karenina, there's a scene where Anna sends her lover Vronsky two notes. The first one she sends by courier, and she says, "Oh, I'm very afraid she's contemplating suicide." But that note doesn't make it to him immediately. Then she sends a telegram, and that one's much more curt. It's kind of this brusque, "Hey, come back immediately." And Vronsky gets the second note first, and so he replies to the telegram and just says, "I'm sorry, I can't come back until tomorrow." Only later does he get the first note, and that one, after he gets that, he says, "Oh my goodness, you know, she's really distressed, she's contemplating suicide, I'll come back immediately." But by that point, it's too late, because she's already made that decision to commit suicide. So I think when we're talking about forfeiture, we're talking about a revocation, a kind of irreversible step. Here it is, the forfeiture of real property rights. Rose LLC is facing a forfeiture. Treasure Island is not facing a forfeiture. When it talks about, you know, forfeiting its right to terminate, no, it's not forfeiting a right to terminate. All it has to do, it has all of those contractual remedies available to it. It could, even without the notice of default, which gives it the right to actually terminate the lease, it has the right to sue for damages. It doesn't relieve Rose of the obligation to pay rent. And, you know, it certainly could follow up a defective notice of default with an effective one. It could simply re-notice the default and thereby exercise that same remedy. So it's not forfeiting any remedy simply because it sent an ineffective or a defective notice of default initially.
So how, you know, when you look at the findings of facts and conclusions of law, you have a finding here by a district court judge that listened to a bench trial, listened to the witnesses, and in the findings, Judge Gonzalez writes that she made a finding that actual notice occurred because Gold called Anthony on May 15th, and that Gold, that's the attorney for, right, Rose, makes a call asking for an extension of time to pay the past due rent. And then makes another finding that there's a partial payment by Susan, whose name I'll mess up. She sends a partial payment. So two different findings of actual notice. How do we reverse the district court based on strict compliance of the lease when you have those types of findings with the district court? She heard the testimony. If she disbelieves Drackle and believes the other witnesses, the two witnesses, how do we reverse based on strict compliance? What law tells this court to reverse?
So the Supreme Court's decision in Leyva, that talks about when you apply a regime of strict compliance versus substantial compliance. It's important to note that actual notice is only relevant in a regime of substantial compliance. When you have, when the requirement is strict compliance, it doesn't matter. In fact, it's sometimes obvious that the parties have actual notice. But the court, if strict compliance is the rule, then it doesn't matter whether you have actual notice. And the more recent case, Pollock versus Dang, from this year, the Supreme Court applied applied that regime in a case where you had a homeowner facing a forfeiture of its property, and you have the redemption statute, right? And there, the Supreme Court was careful. It noted that the that the lienor had, in fact, given notice ahead of the end of that redemption period. And so the homeowner had actual notice that it was facing the forfeiture of its home. But the Supreme Court said, no. We apply this statute, which requires notice in a certain time. Time and manner requirements are generally construed strictly or require strict compliance. And it said, all right, when we have this time requirement, the lienor gave notice too early. The homeowner had actual notice, but it was too early. So that was ineffective notice. The lienor needed to give that notice after the expiration of the redemption period. So I think it's very important. And in fact, in the Leyva case, they also talked about the actual notice being an element of substantial compliance. The Pollock case also talks about the mechanics lien cases, right, where you have a regime of substantial compliance, and that's based on actual notice to the owner of the property being liened, right? And in that case as well, the Supreme Court said, well, we do apply a regime of substantial compliance there, number one, because it's part of the statute. The statute actually says substantial compliance is enough. And number two, because the notice of right to lien, that kind of pre-lien notice, isn't the last step before forfeiting a real property interest. It's a preliminary step. On the other hand, this issue of redemption, that's the last step before the homeowner loses its property. The same situation for Roe. So I don't think it matters whether you have actual notice when the correct standard is a regime of strict compliance.
What would you say, I mean, we really don't have something in a landlord-tenant context here in Nevada saying strict compliance. What from other jurisdictions, what cases would you say would be most on point for this court to consider for your argument of strict compliance
sure.
for landlord-tenant cases in other jurisdictions?
Right, and if you look at a couple cases I think are directly on point, the In Re CNC TV and Appliance, which we cite in our opening brief, and the Oxford Associates Real Estate LP versus TSI Society Hill, Inc. Those cases, almost exactly the situation we have here. It's interesting to note, by the way, that these cases, sorry, I'm looking at my time. these cases rarely come up to a court decision because it is so easy to just re-notice the notice of default. So a lot of times these cases actually come up when there have been successive notices of default, and it turns out that each one of those notices was somehow defective. In the Oxford case, you have the tenant who defaults or who breaches the lease. And I should back up because I accidentally said default, but default is a defined term in the lease, and it requires notice before it ripens in default. But the tenant in that case breached the lease, in other words, didn't pay rent, and the landlord gave notice to someone at the address that was listed as the notice address, but it wasn't the exact parties listed. And the court said, I'm sorry, we have to construe this. We apply strict compliance. It doesn't matter. Actual notice doesn't matter. This is an ineffective notice of default. In the In Re CNC TV and Appliance case, the same issue in this case, the landlord gave notice to the tenant. The tenant itself had actual notice, but didn't copy counsel, which was the requirement in this case as well. And the court again said, no, I'm sorry, under a regime of strict compliance, this is not effective notice.
Could you briefly discuss the joinder issue?
The joinder issue? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
I think you were finished on this other topic, but I'm not sure.
Right, and actually this is a good segue to whether Rose can assert the right in the lease to have notice go to representatives at Senior Frogs and to counsel Ronald Fieldstein and Susan Trench. And so I will address the joinder issue first, which is if Rose is not allowed to, if Rose does not have standing to raise that notice by itself, then what we have is a forfeiture not only of Rose's lease, but automatically of the sublease. There's no way the sublease exists only to the extent that the lease exists. So you have a forfeiture of a sublease without the joinder of the proper parties. In the Gladys Olson case, the Supreme Court talked about how really it is the district court's duty to make sure that the proper parties are joined. And if you have someone with a property interest, in that case it was trust money, but in this case it's real property interest. If you have somebody with a property interest in the litigation, they need to be joined as necessary parties. It's fatal to the judgment if they're not joined. Here, I don't think you need to reach that issue, though, because if Senior Frog's sublease is not disturbed, if the status quo remains the same, then they're not facing that forfeiture. And I think we can just do that by saying Rose.
Well, the problem is, if in fact you're right and Senior Frogs is a necessary party and they're not joined, then what you have is a jurisdictional problem and we can't reach any issue on its merits.
Only to the extent that the Senior Frogs' real property rights are at risk of forfeiture. So if we, at the appellate level, say, look, there was no effective notice of default because Rose itself can assert that the notice didn't go to three of the parties that Rose contracted for as notice to Rose LLC, then you don't need to, then Senior Frog's sublease interest isn't affected by that decision.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll hear from the respondent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Wall for Treasure Island LLC. I have with me today Lieutenant Governor Mark Hutchison and Patrick Sheehan, who are co-counsel. Also in the courtroom with us today is Brad Anthony, who is general counsel for Treasure Island, and the Brad Anthony, who was involved in the matters that we're talking about today. Your Honors, I agree with counsel that this case is about construction of a contract and about breach of a contract. I think that they've cleverly tried to focus the attention of the court on the wrong breach of the contract. The real breach of the contract that brings us here today is that Rose made a conscious choice not to pay rent. Rose knew when the rent was due. They keep saying it's a technical problem here, and the extraordinary remedy of eviction for non-payment of rent. Rent is the quintessential element of a lease, and it's the number one requirement for a tenant is to pay rent and to pay it on time. It's not an extraordinary remedy to terminate a lease. It happens every day, dozens of times in district courts and justice courts right here in Las Vegas. It's when you don't pay the rent, you get evicted. That's what happens. There's no doubt that Rose has been playing a game. There was testimony they're habitually late on paying their rent. They do this. They wait and wait and wait. In order to pay the rent. They knew when the rent was due and they didn't pay it. But now they're
talking about the rent, the percentage amount of it, not the standard monthly amount, but the percentage of revenues?
They knew that the percentage amount was due quarterly. There may have been disputes as to the exact amount, but they knew that the rent was to be paid and needed to be paid, and they did not pay it. They received the funds from Senior Frogs to pay that rent. They misappropriated those funds. We don't know what they did with those funds, but they didn't pay rent with it. And then they say, we didn't get notice, and they have basically, their whole argument is this strict liability argument, the strict construction of the contract, which they don't have any case law which supports, which is why we see him quoting at length case law regarding a statute, a redemption statute, which courts have held redemption statutes have to be strictly applied. Then we have the case law that he's discussed. I'll get to that very quickly, but I want to suggest first that it's not a forfeiture of their lease right. We're not here talking about forfeiture. They don't want to talk about not paying the rent, so they have to create something that isn't based on substantial evidence, because Judge Gonzalez heard the case and found substantial evidence to support every element of the cause of action for eviction, and so they want to turn this into a legal question. And so they say, generic cases about forfeitures or not are disfavored in the law, and this is a forfeiture. And they say, well, we don't have a Treasure Island doesn't have a forfeiture. We're the ones with a forfeiture because we're losing our lease. It's not a forfeiture. It's a termination of the lease under the terms of the lease for non-payment of rent.
Well, I have a question. What about the fact that, you know, Judge Gonzalez finds an oral modification at some point that the payments are only going to go to Draggle? I'm going to say his name wrong. And then even after that, you go into that Fifth Amendment. And in the Fifth Amendment, nobody puts in, oh, all the payments are going to go to him.
It's big.
Why is that? I mean, why go at length to change the address, change all of Senor Frog's parties of who the notice goes to, but leave out that oral modification? Why go into the Fifth Amendment at all?
Because to characterize the contract in that manner is revisionist history of what actually happened. The Fifth Amendment had nothing to do with notice. Nobody ever negotiated for different notice in the Fifth Amendment. That wasn't what that was about. The Fifth Amendment was about amending the problem that they were no longer going to provide the pirate show, and so they were going to give less rent. And then there's a provision in there that says, oh, by the way, our new address is this. Mm. And they gave the new address and said notices should be sent there. Most important about that of everything is because the whole determination about whether or not there was an agreement to send notices only to Mr. Dragol has to do with the direct notice. It has nothing to do with notice. I mean, has to do with the notice to Senior Frogs. Has nothing to do with the direct notice as it comes down in this case, because the requirement to give notice to Marcouche was eliminated with the Fifth Amendment. It's interesting to note that Fifth Amendment was signed on the same day the rent that wasn't paid was due. It's not like they didn't know that their rent was due and they weren't going to pay it. And then 2 weeks go by, and then they haven't paid the rent. Notice is given. They don't pay the rent. Marcouche, who is supposed to be the one who will take care of this and needs to get notice, had notice. There was testimony from Mr. Dragol himself that she attempted a partial payment. She says, well, or he says, I don't know whether that was in response to the notice or just because she noticed the rent was due. But it was, number one, a partial payment during the period of time. They made an express choice not to fully pay the rent when they had an obligation to do so. That's what the testimony is. And what is happening here is they're trying to read the contract to aggrandize the notice provisions as though they're the only provisions in the rent, and that they were bargained for, consideration given for those things. And that's not how, if you really look at the rent.
Did they ever take her depot, Susan? Did they take her depot at all? Was her depot offered to the district court? It doesn't appear.
There are many things that don't appear in the record, and most importantly were all of the exhibits at trial that don't appear in the record, which would support many of these things. I don't know.
I have a question on that, too. I could have sworn in your brief you mentioned something about Exhibit 66 being the check for partial payment of the rent. But then in their opening brief, it's almost as if, and I'm not sure which it is, even going back to the transcript, I can't figure it out. Was that partial payment check in evidence, or was it just a question of the attorney?
Well, it was one of the exhibits, and they say that that exhibit was never entered into evidence, but there's no citation in that brief to where that is, and I couldn't find that from the record that was presented, and I don't have Exhibit 66 to look at, or anything that goes with whether the exhibits were admitted or not. But what I do have in the record is Mr. Dragol's testimony, where he admits the check was made out and was sent. Mm-hmm. And and it was a partial payment. It was during that period of time. So not only was the notice to Mr. Dragol an appropriate notice, it was sent to the address, the very address in the Fifth Amendment that says this is where to send it. The whole suggestion that attention Susan Marcouche in a provision that says this is the address where you send notices is somehow a substantive provision of the contract on which they were relying, and this whole she's the one I rely on, I had to get, if that was true, you would have language in the contract that talks about that. It's not really that at all. It's just here's the address where you send notice, and attention, Susan Markush. And then the next time they gave us that address, she's not even on there, and they ignore the fact that she got actual notice. She was in the office every day, and the notice was delivered there and signed for. So what they're trying to do is say strict compliance with notice is required, and they have all these cases about strict compliance with notice being required, and they ignore that we admit if the issue is actual notice or effective notice, if the issue is substantive notice, well, they're entitled to that notice. But if they have found some technical form over substance problem with that notice, that would be a substantial compliance analysis. And that gets us to their cases. Oxford, they say, well, in Oxford, they sent sent the notices to one party but not another, and because of that, the notice wasn't valid. That's not true if you read Oxford in its entirety. There were multiple issues in Oxford. Number one was that the payment was to be approximately $260,000, and all of it was paid except there was a dispute that the payment was $12,000 short. There was a dispute over that amount. So one of the main issues in that was whether or not the payment of most of that rent was substantial compliance by the tenant. Another issue was the issue of the fact that the notice wasn't exactly compliant, and there were three notices. And one of the notices was clearly not compliant, and the other two didn't suggest a termination. They just asked for payment. So they didn't have the substance in those notices that was required to start the period of time. And the court said that relied heavily on the substantial performance of partial payment of the rent. That's the Oxford case, the CNC TV case. Two notices were sent. The first one was arguably defective. The second one was not defective, but the problem with the second one was that bankruptcy petition was filed, and this was in a bankruptcy court, and it was a magistrate, and it was affirmed by a bankruptcy court judge that the magistrate had substantial evidence to reach the decision that he reached. And what happened there was the time period for compliance had not expired before the bankruptcy petition was filed. Putting all of that together, the court said that the decision was not clearly erroneous under the law. That is not the decision that every notice provision and everything in it, which we, after the fact, decide is important because we're looking for a reason to justify our own breach of contract, is a substantive part of that notice provision. What they contracted for, the same thing as with Saladino. The notices were supposed to be given to the tenant and the subtenant. They only gave the notice to the subtenant. The tenant never even got the notice. And in each one of those cases, in fact, in the CNC TV case, they said strict compliance is required so long as it is consistent with the intent of the parties. They didn't just say you always strictly have to comply with all notice provisions. They said if it's consistent with the contract and the intent of the parties. In other words, there's always going to, in the cases that we cited for substantial compliance, there's always going to be a weighing process here when we're not talking about did they get notice because they did get notice, did they ignore the notice because they did ignore the notice. We're talking about here, oh man, we messed up. Lawyer, can you find something in this contract that we can say they breached so that we can hang our hat on that breach rather than addressing the real issue in the case, which is the fact that they didn't pay rent, and they have continued to not pay rent.
Well, Mr. Walk, can we switch gears? Why isn't Senior Frogs part of this case? Shouldn't that company have been joined?
When we get to Senior Frogs, this is where we have the issue. Senior Frogs knew about this case. They were actually a part of it. Their president testified in the case. His testimony was completely incredible, and Judge Gonzalez said so. And
because they liked the lease under Rose, they didn't want to start a new lease with you. properly?
Well, Senior Frogs, as soon as they got notice of the termination, they sent their president sent a notice that said, we're not going to be involved in this. Oh, and by the way, after you get done with Rose, just please confirm that you're going to renegotiate a sublease with us.
Right.
That was their concern. Their concern wasn't we didn't get notice. Their concern wasn't we would have cured this. It's highly unlikely, as Judge Gonzalez said, they would have cured since they'd already paid the rent once. Why would they pay it again? They had already sent the rent money to Rose, and Rose had not paid the rent. There's no indication in the record that there was some intention that they would have cured this, and there's, more importantly, no intention, nothing in the record other than after-the-fact supposition that Treasure Island wanted to get out of this lease. They signed the Fifth Amendment on the day that the money was due. They weren't trying to get out of the lease. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. Number two, that
What was the date of the Fifth Amendment again? As to what was the date of the Fifth Amendment? I'm sorry. I can find out. Go ahead. Sorry. Just when you said something. Go ahead.
The point is, the judge...
Hold on, Mr. Ball. You've said that certain things happened with Senior Frogs, but they were not a party, so they couldn't argue in court, they couldn't file any briefs, they couldn't participate in settlement conferences, they can't argue here today.
And they weren't... That's right. And they weren't a necessary party to this action, and that issue was never raised below. No, nobody ever said before the briefs in this case.
That makes no difference. Well, unfortunately, it seems like it should, but under the law, it doesn't.
Well, it is jurisdictional. That means the court can hear the issue, but doesn't need to hear the issue just because it's jurisdictional, if, in fact, the court believes that they were a necessary party. But
you remember
that
case with Jerry Tarkanian when he was sued by the NCAA? And that case went all the way through, and the Supreme Court said, oh, but you know, we don't have everybody here. We're reversing on this thing.
Exactly. If they really were a necessary party, but if you go through and look at the issues, they're not. And the judge found five reasons why notice to them wasn't required anyway. And each one of those five reasons...
they can still sue under the sublease. They can still sue Rose.
They can still sue. Judge Gonzalez made it very clear that she was not affecting their... She made it very clear on the record she wasn't affecting their rights at all. They still have their rights to sue if they were damaged.
Really simple. You just get all the parties there on one case and this issue never comes up. And
they're not a party to the lease. And all we're terminating is the lease.
But their rights were affected.
Their rights were affected, but not in a way that would make them a necessary party. And that's the issue that is being raised for the first time, which should, the elements are just not there. Sorry, my time is up.
Thank
you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll start briefly with the issue about the record, Exhibit 66. As we noted on page 33 of our reply brief, Exhibit 66 was introduced into evidence, and it was a check from 2014, a year before the alleged default. That's the issue in this case. It was regarding a different notice of default.
Okay, so I got them mixed up because she did make findings, though, that a partial payment was sent.
She made partial findings, and I don't want to say that this makes any difference because I think this is a legal issue, but I will note that the evidence that the court relied on to make that finding was argument from counsel asking Mr. Dragle basically to assume that Ms. Marcouche had made such a payment and then showing him exhibits that were not introduced into evidence.
Although Dragle, didn't he admit on the stand that a payment was in fact sent with the check on that date? He just didn't know. He didn't know when the check was sent, but that the check was dated the 14th or 15th.
Yeah, since.
But he admitted that on the stand. That's evidence when you admit something on the stand.
And again, I don't think this makes a difference. So if she did see the check, if she did see the notice of default and sent a partial payment, I don't think that makes a difference because again, actual notice is not the rule. But again, his quote unquote admission was based on a counsel telling him that there was a check. He was never shown a check. In fact, Treasure Island's counsel admitted that they didn't have that check, that it didn't exist, that it wasn't in their possession, but showed him, I believe, a FedEx receipt. That wasn't admitted into evidence. It's a little hard to evaluate on what basis he made that admission. But I would be comfortable.
What about gold, though? That's certainly an omission.
And again, it's, so.
And there was an email confirming that conversation.
Right, but look back at the. I'd like to look back at the lease itself, talking about the where notice needs to go. Ms. Gold is unequivocally not a contact for Rose LLC to receive notice. Susan Marcouche was, but she wasn't sent notice. Even if she saw the notice wasn't sent to her attention. And it's undisputed that the three contacts for Senior Frogs itself, the Susan Trench, and Ronald Fieldstone, were never sent that notice. I think it's important to note that the contractual remedy of that the parties agreed to of how you terminate the lease, rather than suing for breach. We never dispute that they have a remedy to sue for breach. They can get the rental payments back. But to actually terminate the lease, that it needs to go to all four of those contractual designees. Otherwise, it's not effective notice under the lease. Briefly, on the point of Senior Frogs not being joined to the case, of course, they participated in the case because they were called as witnesses. But that's very
why didn't they intervene then? I mean, you got the guy on the stand. Why wouldn't he have intervened if he was so worried about the breach? They certainly could have had an attorney come in and intervene.
No question they could, possibly they could have intervened.
I mean, you guys even did a motion for reconsideration, and you didn't put in there that they're indispensable parties, so judge reconsider.
Okay, and I believe that the Gladys Olson case makes very clear that it isn't the parties, the party whose property is affected, it's not their duty to intervene. It's the duty of the party that's trying to eliminate that property interest. It's their duty to join the party, and that's something that this court needs to address.
So, other than the theory that they weren't included in this litigation, one of the concerns about Rule 19 is you want all the parties there so that you don't have piecemeal litigation, especially if the litigation could end up with inconsistent or incompatible results.
Correct.
So, whatever claim Senior Frogs has, if it asserts it now in a separate litigation against whoever it wants to assert it, what's the chance that there's going to be any sort of inconsistent judgment between what happens in the next hypothetical next case versus what's already happened here?
Great, especially if in the second case the judge finds that no, in fact the lease to which Senior Frogs was a sublease should not have been terminated in the first place. Now you have a judgment saying the lease is terminated, and you have a second court.
How
saying,
do they abstain? They're not party to that lease.
Which is, and I agree that Senior Frogs doesn't have standing under this lease, but they have standing as a sublessee because their property rights are affected. But more importantly, it's that very point that you address, that you bring up, that Senior Frogs doesn't have standing to enforce this notice provision under the lease. Who does have standing? It's Rose LLC that has standing to enforce that notice provision in its entirety. We've cited the cases to you that say that a party to a contract has the right to enforce every provision. And with that, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your argument. This case will now stand submitted.